Do you ever get that feeling that you're an immortal being in a chrysalis, dreaming the universe? If so, then that means you're listening to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour. I'm not going to read this. Jason, we got to talk.
What's your problem, man? That's a great intro.
No, it's not. It's weird for the sake of weird. It doesn't make any sense. It's just like some kind of psychedelic bullshit. Everybody knows the whole brain in the jar, maybe you're a slug in a swamp dreaming that you're human thing. I've done it 70 times at least in the intro. So it's come up with something new, something creative, something inspirational.
This is something you wrote yesterday. I think it will make a greater opening monologue.
This better be good.
It's good.
For more than two centuries, the U.S. Senate has required the support of at least 60 senators before they pass a major piece of legislation. That makes for a cumbersome system. It requires compromise and patience. It delays the passage of laws. But it has endured through the centuries despite the leadership of the body. At times, the Senate has been controlled by Republicans. Other times, it's been controlled by Democrats. But that standard, the standard of 60 votes, often referred to as the filibuster rule, has never changed. We've had it since 1806 when Thomas Jefferson was the president. Why is that? It's not just because the U.S. senators tend to be pompous and mindlessly wedded to tradition, though obviously they are. It's because this is a democracy. Sober people know that before you make a big change to a country, you better be certain that a large... This is a fucking Tucker Carlson monologue.
So what? It's good writing.
Jason, please stop doing that Swedish accent and tell me what I always tell you about political monologues.
You say that pundits and monologists are attempting to lock human consciousness to the past by wrapping our minds in semantic chains that keep us frozen in time, and that the moment humanity as a whole turns away from charismatic fearmongers will be the moment that our species achieves universal consciousness, and that this global gnosis is being forestalled by matter-addicted money hoarders who are desperately trying to prevent the disintegration of the stultifying reality tunnel we were all born into.
I never said that. I said they suck, is what I said. And you're fired, Jason. You're fired.
You can't fire me because I quit.
Fuck you. Ugh. Go, there's another writer, no need I. Who writer need to do job any one do? Simple do job, no need Jason, commercial now. Big thanks to DHM Detox for sponsoring this episode of the DTFH. DHM Detox is the vitamin for people who like to enjoy alcohol. It's the smart, responsible way to enjoy your booze. It's time to start taking care of your body when you drink. Get a much-needed immunity boost while you're enjoying your favorite drink. Enjoy your drinks without that awful next day. Forget the nausea, brain fog, anxiety, or headaches. Their company is built on the words, no days wasted. There's a misconception that the awful next day feeling is caused by dehydration, but that's not actually the case. It's because of the buildup of alcohol's toxic byproduct. DHM Detox uses science to help boost your body's natural response to alcohol and help break down those toxins. Their key ingredient, DHM, is a plant extract that has been used in Asia for centuries while drinking alcohol. It comes from a plant known as the Tree of the Gods, made up of natural ingredients, antioxidants, and vitamins. Just take two capsules after your first couple of drinks and it goes to work. Double up and take another packet if you're having a big night. They come in convenient packets that are easy to share with friends and family while you're celebrating or socializing. How important is your next day? For just a couple of dollars, you can wake up feeling fine after drinking. Also, there's free shipping on all U.S. orders. DHM Detox, it's a risk-free purchase. So if you aren't satisfied after taking the product, they'll give you your money back. It's a no-brainer. I've got you 20% off your order. Just head over to DHMDetox.com and use promo code Duncan at checkout. That's DHMDetox.com. If you have any questions, send a message to DHMDetox on Instagram. Do you experience stress or have anxiety or chronic pain? Trouble sleeping at least once a week? You're definitely not alone. I know I sure as fuck do. How are you supposed to get a good night's sleep during a pandemic? I've always had insomnia, though. I'm not going to blame it on the pandemic. My mom had it. Sure, I could say the reason I have insomnia is because of the secret war that I fought when I was a CIA operative, much like the Bourne Identity, but then I'd be leaking data. So let's just say I don't sleep that well. But now I do, thanks to Feels. It really does help me sleep. You just take a few drops, put it under your tongue, and voila. If you don't know what CBD is, if you're new to it, they have a free CBD hotline that you can call. It's not addictive. It doesn't get you high, so you don't have to worry about getting paranoid or blasted or freaking out. It's just a nice, sweet droplet of Mother Nature's healing nectar in the form of a beautiful amber-colored liquid. Feels, it has me feeling my best every day, and it can help you too. Become a member today by going to feels.com/Duncan, and you'll get 50% off your first order with free shipping. That's FEALS.com/Duncan to become a member and get 50% off automatically. Taking off your first order with free shipping. Feels.com/Duncan. Allow nature's secretions to come dripping into your hamburger hole. Feels. The last part I made up. They don't say to say it goes in your hamburger hole. That's me. Back now we meet enough to make sounds and do the voice to make intro happen for podcast show. No writer need. In come. Jason?
I forgot my banjo.
Jason, look, Chance want to give you another.
Yay. I'm so happy to be back. It makes me want to dance and sing. Dance and sing. Dance, dance, dance and sing. Dance and sing. Sing, sing and dance.
Boy, do we have a great podcast for you today. Lon Milo Duquette, the great writer, musician, and practitioner of ceremonial magic, is here with us today. We're going to jump right into it. But first, this. A deep thank you to the DTFH Patreon family that keeps my darling boy in silken diapers. If you're interested in commercial-free episodes of the DTFH, if you want to gather with your true family, if you want to get together for weekly video gatherings, we have a Dune book club. The second week starts tonight. We've got a Tuesday meditation, and we've got a Friday DTFH family gathering. We're all waiting for you. Also, there's a fantastic Discord server. You'll instantly have access to gobs of content, and you'll be able to sink your teeth into the inner spinal gel of this podcast. So head over to patreon.com/DTFH and subscribe. We also have a wonderful shop located at duncantrussell.com with all kinds of beautiful face masks for you to wear. Head over to the shop at duncantrussell.com. Now, let's get this podcast going. The introduction to today's guest was actually made for me by one of my beloved family members during a DTFH family gathering on Patreon. Somebody asked, do you know Lon Milo Duquette? Of course, I'd heard of him. I'm someone who is an armchair occult scholar. I like reading Crowley. I'm not a practicing ceremonial magician. But anyone who knows anything about the occult has heard the name Lon Milo Duquette. And within minutes after saying I'd love to talk with him on a podcast, I was connected, and he was kind enough to appear on the show. Lon Milo Duquette has written over 18 books on various occult topics. He's a lecturer, and he is a high-ranking member of the OTO, the Order Temple Orientalis, which is a projection of Aleister Crowley's mind into the world. He's the real deal. I was actually kind of nervous to chat with him and was relieved to find that he's a super sweet, awesome, mystical person. He's got a lot of great content out there. Check out his many YouTube lectures on the tarot and other occult topics. You can head over to his Facebook page. He gives live streams there, I think, at least every week. All the links you need to find that will be at DuncanTrussell.com. And now, everybody, please welcome to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour Podcast, Lon Milo Duquette. Lon, welcome to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour Podcast. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for asking me on.
Well, I have known about you for a very long time, as anybody who has any mild interest in the occult is aware of your existence. And I think maybe anybody who has any interest in the occult is maybe a little nervous when it comes to your existence somehow. In the sense that I don't know enough about about magic and the occult to be anything more than a little trepidatious. And as I was researching you, I was thrilled to find that you had a similar reaction to the Crowley Thoth tarot deck that I had when I first encountered it, which is my reaction was, it's of the devil.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's so weirdly beautiful that if you're used to sort of, you know, the standard sort of, you know, medieval-y artwork that you usually associate with tarot, and you see these beautiful Frieda Harris, like modern art cubist kind of paintings, you're stunned by the beauty of them, and at the same time they're so beautiful that they disturb you, just like the listeners, the audience to Paganini, the great violinist and composer. He played the violin so weirdly wonderful and better than anybody else that the jealous other violinists said, well, nobody can play like that. The devil had to make him play like that, you know, like Robert Johnson.
Yeah.
He plays guitar so good, the devil had to. And then people sort of kind of believe that, but it's kind of easy to believe when something is so supernaturally awesome for you to you know, question the source of its mysteriousness. And that's how I felt about the Thoth Tarot for a while, because I was still a superstitious young fool.
But, you know, this is what I was hoping you could maybe unencumber me from this superstitious quality. I have Libra 4. I refer to it all the time. I can't imagine that I understand much of it. I love the Kabbalah. I study it. And also, you know, suddenly my dreams will change, or any time that I have, when I'm meditating sometimes, you know, I'll have some strange experience that reminds me of something that I've read in Crowley or have heard about in occult traditions. And almost every single time this happens, a defense mechanism pops up inside of me that makes me feel afraid. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what that could be. I mean, outside of whatever my own subjective bullshit is, every grimoire I've ever looked at, in general, they all start with this kind of warning at the beginning. Beware, beware. And magic in general, it's so many people I know are fundamentalists, generally raised in the Christian tradition, but often Buddhism. Certainly Islam. There's quite often a general sense that this is the wrong way, the left-hand path, damnation waits ahead for those who decide to start looking into these matters deeply.
Well, we're always more comfortable with what we think the faith of our fathers is, and we seldom think that, you know, as the world is going completely insane around us, we at least try to take comfort in the old reality of the faith of our fathers, but we seldom stop to think that it's the faith of our fathers that is a really big super reason why the world has gone so hellishly mad
right.
in the first place. Look at it this way.
Oh, Mr. Duquette, I apologize. Is your phone off the hook? I hear something.
Yes, it is. I just took it off the hook for a second. It'll go away.
Okay, thank you.
I just didn't want it to...
I appreciate that. Thank you.
People are always trying to sell me roofing.
I get Carnival Cruise Line offers.
But most of us, if we were truthful with ourselves, will admit that... that we're pretty screwed up. We're not firing on all cylinders. Mm. We're not viewing our existence clearly. And so all of our self-identity is pretty much invested in a very unreal and unrealistic and inaccurate view of ourselves. I think almost anybody will admit that.
Yes.
And any kind of, you know, tried and true mystical meditations, whether it be yogic meditations, breath exercises, anything that tends to rebalance yourself or to bring a certain amount of harmony and readjustment to ourselves, our old self-identity with the screwed up Duncan doesn't want to be an unscrewed up Duncan.
That's right.
The unscrewed up Duncan is afraid of losing its identity.
Yes.
And so it kicks up all sorts of reactions to getting its shit together. Okay. This, I don't want my shit to get together. Otherwise I won't be the Duncan I always thought I was.
Right.
And so that kicks back at you in dreams, whatever these new forces of harmony and balance is making me dizzy, is making the old Duncan dizzy, is making the old Duncan afraid that you're losing the old Duncan. And so you personify those fears as demonic attacks on yourself, when actually what they are very wholesome attacks on the old screwed up Duncan.
Wholesome attacks. I love it. Yeah. Well, I've sort of grokked that. I've had a sense when working with magic, and, you know, many of my friends practice ceremonial magic. Some friends who've been on the podcast have spent their lives absorbed in it. And sometimes they I don't want to say frustrated, but curious about why I don't do more than read with it. And it's just, you know, because I feel like there's so many possibilities within it to truly lose yourself, but not like lose the sort of neurotic self, but literally blow yourself out of the water, so to speak, that, You know, and there's so many stories of people who have, you know, decided to start working with these energies and have gone and had manic episodes or,
right.
you know, sort of lost their orientation, lost their center. And one of the things I love about the books, I love about Crowley, I love about the stories is that they don't pretend that isn't a possibility. You know, whereas like in, you know, other religions, at least when they start telling you about it, they don't mention some of the other stuff. There's a sense of like, well, you're going to get some tranquility here. But at least with magic up front, they're like, you could lose your mind. You know, yeah. I've always respected that about it.
Well, as a spiritual art form, magic is not really helpful to those who are currently prone to run away from themselves.
Ah.
The whole idea of magic is to run into yourself,
yeah.
to discover yourself. And it is the worst of all possible spiritual art forms to use to run away from yourself. And so because it amplifies, you know, existing pathologies, it's if you're a little screwed up to begin with, and you're not grasping the big picture of what magic is, it will amplify your screwed upness in a very loud, boisterous and embarrassing way.
Okay, I love that. Now that makes sense to me. It's same with psychedelics. You know, it's if you're, you know, if set and setting, I suppose it would apply to magic too. If you're in a place where you're not really wanting to look at stuff, do you think this is the reason that compared to some of the other mystical traditions out there, magic has a kind of secrecy attached to it? Is it because of having recognized its potency, practitioners want to, as much as possible, keep people from working with it until they're ready?
Well, it's wise not to work with it until you're ready, and it sort of has its own self regulating mechanisms in it. Magic has its own governor, like a machine's governor. If a lot of people are attracted to it because they think it's what it's not.
Mm.
And those that are attracted to it because they perceive or sense what it is, become very good magicians. And those that perceive that it's something else, like a power, a power trip thing.
Yes.
My God. then magic has a sense of or has a habit of blowing up in their face, and that can be very a very colorful thing because magic is a colorful and dramatic art form.
Yes.
The idea of a magician that's actually making it work is probably the kind of magician that you see and hear about the least because they're not blowing up in front of you.
Right. That is beautiful. That makes sense too. Wow. If you're living on planet Earth right now, or even if you're living within the hollow interior of the planet in one of the ancient, beautiful cities down there, then you're aware that Squarespace is the best place to go if you want to build a website or buy a domain name. But did you know that Squarespace will help you send beautiful, sublime emails to your clients, your friends, your family, anyone who you want to send an email to? You can send a beautiful email to them, not some crappy text-based thing, but you can use Squarespace's powerhouse of amazing technology to send beautiful newsletters to your clients. Squarespace, they've got everything you need to create a beautiful website. Mix and match templates. You want to make a website in a second? You can do it with Squarespace. Well, it's going to be more than a second, but you know what I mean. Under an hour. And if you want to make a complex, powerful thing of such awe-inspiring beauty that it would make the angels weep, much like DuncanTrussell.com, then Squarespace will take you as deep as you want to go, baby. Get in there. Head over to squarespace.com/Duncan. Give it a try. And when you're ready to launch, use offer code Duncan, and you're going to get 10% off your first order of a domain or a website. Again, that's squarespace.com/Duncan. Use offer code Duncan to get 10% off your first order of a website or a domain. Thank you, Squarespace. You know that there, I practice Vajrayana Buddhism. I've got a meditation teacher. Anytime I start chatting with him about, you know, experiences during the practice, he always just brings me back to the sort of earthy kind of like, well, you know, things do happen when you're meditating, but this is not about going after like cities, as you know, because it's an Eastern tradition. Mm-hmm. If you start getting too caught up in getting all the, you know, whatever it is, the extra bells and whistles, then you sort of miss the point. Yeah. Is that true for magic as well? Is there any difference?
Oh, absolutely. You know, a lot of times in the East, they say certain practices bring you certain magical powers.
Yes.
But what they don't tell, and that's true, but what they don't tell you is by the time you get those magical powers, they're a pain in the ass and not anything that you want to flaunt. Okay.
Right.
The magical powers aren't really magical powers. They're just, that's how people normally should be when they become more themselves. We are naturally empathetic. We're naturally telepathic. We're naturally we naturally can more or less read each other's minds, but the screwed up Duncan and Lon don't. Okay. So it's, and to think that you're practicing pranayama for 14 years in order to get the magical ability to read somebody's mind, you're really hitching your wagon to a false star when you should be hitching that wagon to yourself.
Wow. That is, to me, but what a paradox. I mean, you can't blame us for wanting, like, what kid hasn't wanted to fly? Or if you hear about this potential for astral projection or lucid dreaming, of course you're going to want to do that. Or, you know, just like how many times have you thought, God, I wish I was telekinetic, not for some grand reason, but just to like get the remote control, to levitate the remote control off the floor to your hand, you know? Of course we would want these cities. So it seems somewhat paradoxical that...
Crowley tells the story, or he gives the example that let's say a person is serious about learning magic, and at first he's serious about learning magic because he wants to kill an enemy at a distance.
Yes. So,
first of all, any spirit that would be capable of doing something like that, and a spirit's a metaphor for your own powers, of course, would immediately think, boy, what a chicken shit magician this is. Why doesn't he just go knock on the door and punch the guy in the nose?
You know? Right.
But he says, well, you know, if that's your reason to learn magic, that's okay. Because in order for you to get and understand the power to do something like that, you would have to understand the entire hierarchy of spiritual forces in the universe, and you'd have to know which spirit is in charge of which other spirit, which is in charge of which other spirits, which is controlled by which angel, and which angel is controlled by which archangel, and which archangel is connected and under the rulership of which facet of Godhead itself, in order for you to do that. And then you have to be able to actually properly invoke that facet of Godhead in yourself so you could trigger that entire hierarchy of spiritual forces. By the time you do that, it's going to be the last thing on your mind. Kill that asshole down the street.
Right. It's like you're that it reminds me of growing up or something, or there seems to be some mirror of just the way children grow into adults and what you're talking about. But this is the other, to me, the real exciting thing about magic, as I, you know, foggily don't understand it, or my just, you know, conjecture, is there is this sense that there's a way to keep growing up. There, you don't, the thing we most people consider to be adulthood is really not much better than a toddler. And that this thing that you're talking about, this possibility of beginning to, at the very least, see these connections, seems to be a continuation of some kind of evolutionary process. It seems like the difference being, in this case, this is something someone does by choice, you know, which is odd to me. Like, you know, I guess you could say my child has learned to walk by choice, but it seems more of a kind of like instinctual process that's unfolding. But this seems to be, you can decide if you want to see this landscape you're describing. Is that true? Is it by choice, or are we all just sort of being sort of inhaled into the Godhead, whether we like it or not? And the more that we get inhaled, the more we pretend we're doing it on purpose.
Well, the from our present position, we're doing it on purpose, and this is something that we make a conscious, voluntary decision to do. The Crowley and the Thelemic doctrine of magic sort of sees the last 10,000 years or more in human evolution. It breaks it up into three categories. There was a time when we were so focused on just putting food in our bellies that we sensed the our spiritual identity tied up with the earth. God was sort of personified by the mother. Yeah, you know, who seemed, you know, if we don't have a 9-month attention span at that point, she seems to just bring forth, you know, other people just right out of her body, just like the earth brings plants and animals right out of the earth.
Right.
So we're all hung up on the earth and the mother and indirectly the moon because of the 9-month cycle of, you know, all of that.
Yes.
You know, all of our magical identity was hung up with that. It was, a woman was awesome. She's still awesome, but she was like the awesome singularity that we're, if we're just not plugged into that teat directly, we're nothing.
Right.
And then we didn't pay much attention to the sun or the cycles or things like that. But then it got to the point of where human consciousness started to wake up just a little bit, and we started to say, hey, these animals don't come, these plants don't grow unless the sun is is on all, for greater hours of the day. And I think that sun has something to do with that. And that realization, that awakening in human consciousness came about the same time as we developed a 9-month attention span and realized that the woman wasn't going to bring forth another human duplicate without the intervention of the male. So the man and the male god started to say, well, the male god's just as important as the female because they need each other. And so the idea that we woke up to the fact that, well, it's a partnership between the sun and the sun of the and the earth. And but then that projected a superstition on us and a fear on us because, shit, the sun goes down every day. I mean, it's gone.
Yeah.
And we have no idea whether that's going to come up. So we started just to freak out, and everything became a death cult.
Wow.
And this duality thing entered in. I mean, it was a step forward, but it's still not very accurate point of view of the universe.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm going to stop you there because you blew my mind. This is crazy. You're saying that there was a period, of course, obviously, I never thought of this. There's a period in human history where when the sun went down, that might be the last time you see that thing.
Yeah,
you could be in eternal darkness forever.
You got to invent a priestcraft to promise that it's going to come up in the morning. And
wow.
Okay. And so all of our gods die and come back to life. See?
Wow.
That's the Osirian thing, and that's the Christian formula.
Got it.
And but now it's been long enough that the majority of the population of the earth and our collective consciousness together now knows that the sun pretty much stays on all the time.
Right.
And it's the earth that's going around. No big deal. The sun's, sun doesn't come up. It's on all the time.
Yes.
So deep down inside, we've come to the conclusion, whether we admit it to ourselves or not, that we stay on all the time. And that if we're conscious now, we've always been conscious, we'll always be conscious. Now immortality isn't something that we have to bribe some spiritual force to achieve. We have immortality. We're on, we'll always be on. Night is an illusion. Death is an illusion.
Woo! That is so cool. But how incredibly for a lot of people, that what you just said is blasphemy. And from the perspective of the atheist, but not just from the perspective of the atheist, it's what you're suggesting, it sounds like, is, there's really nothing to worry about.
Well, there's never anything to worry about ultimately, but the only reason I took us on that little trip was the formula of the goddess, two awakenings ago, was one of just nourishment. Mm. And the formula of the Osirian formula, the last one where we thought the sun went down, was a formula of life and death. Okay. But the new formula, the new awakening, where we know the sun stays on all the time, is simply one of simple growth. It's a god of growth. And so Crowley, labeled them, Isis, then Osiris, and now their son, their baby, Horus. And so the formula that works for us now is simply the simple, wholesome formula of the growth of consciousness. And we're no longer stuck with this life-death duality formula of the previous incarnation or the previous aeon or age. Now it is our natural tendency to view everything, all of our spiritual formula, all of our self-identity, with the fact that, hey, we grow. We don't even have to micromanage the conditions of our growth. Just like a kid, you know, he
right.
all of a sudden he needs new shoes.
Yeah.
He needs new clothes to go to school the next year. It's just growth. He doesn't even feel about it. It's totally natural. It's an unfolding of a flower, but it's now an unfolding of consciousness. And whether we admit it to ourselves or not, we are in the process of unfolding that flower. And so we could look at all of the problems that we're having with this unfolding in the same way as we would view the different stages of a flower unfolding, as if the flowers said, no, I don't want to be a bud anymore. Oh, my budness is dying. You know,
yeah.
and not realizing that their identity is now unfolding. The chrysalis is becoming a new kind of butterfly thing. And but because you just can't stop the growth, we're in a position of being drugged, kicking and screaming into our own awakening. and that has its growing pains involved in it. And that's sort of the wild chaoticness that we're experiencing right now as the shift of consciousness is starting to take hold.
Wow. Gosh, that is so cool. That is so curious to me that we don't want to grow. That I get it, I guess. I mean, I guess I remember there was a time when I was like going to graduate high school. And I felt weirdly sentimental about high school and had this really embarrassing fantasy that, like, you know what? Maybe I'll just become a teacher here.
Yeah.
You know, is that what we're talking about?
That's exactly what we're talking about.
Wow. That is so cool. Huh. Wow. We just want to stay in high school. We don't want to go to college. It was it's easy in high school.
But most of us will agree we don't want to stay in junior high.
You're damn right we don't.
We've all awakened to that revelation.
Got it. So magic, is magic a thing that expedites the unfolding or just helps it be less painful or both? Or is there a way to speed this growth up? Or is that what magic is?
Well, there's a just like in our physical bodies, there are ways to better nourish the vehicle that is growing. Just like, you know, vitamin supplements and mineral supplements and eating the right food and stuff. There's a way that you can make your body unfold in a more natural, wholesome, and efficient manner. But magic hasn't cornered the market on techniques to help people grow, and not everybody resonates to the art form of magic, just like everyone doesn't resonate to the art form of monastic life, not everyone resonates to yogic practices or tantric practices, or some people resonate to music. Magic is an art. It's a science, all right, in the same way as music is a science. Mm. But first and foremost, it's an art. So every magician is an artist. Not only that, every artist is a magician.
Wow.
And no two artists are alike, and they shouldn't be. And in my little talk this morning on my reading, my Facebook reading this morning, I was reading from a book of mine. Picasso and Monet, they could argue with each other on the virtues or the qualities of oil paints versus watercolors or pastels.
Right.
But they couldn't argue with each other, and they needn't, and they shouldn't. They couldn't argue with each other over the nature of truth. And every artist has their own truth duties to express, and every magician has the same thing. As far as motive goes, as we said earlier, the probably the most unworthy motive for magic is to try to run away from yourself in your art.
Right. It's like not listening to your inspiration when you're creating something. It would be akin to like having some epiphanous idea of a thing you wanted to make and then not making it because you're afraid or something sad like that.
Right. You turn yourself into a Strasbourg goose.
Wow. I think I can get a little bit more of a grasp on it by talking about art. In particular, with whatever the particular art form is, there's obviously some structure to it. Music, there's clearly a structure. There's scales, there's frequencies, there's practice involved. But also mixed in with it is absolute freedom in the sense of what it is you're going to use the tools to create. With magic, sometimes I wonder about what isn't magic. How much of magic is just listening to your own intuition and sort of allowing that intuition to flow into the world in your own made-up ceremonies or rituals or prayers? Is that just hogwash? Is that just you fooling yourself into imagining that you're doing magic when in fact there is like sort of a right way to do it?
All the books on magic, and you get your Golden Dawn books, and you get your Keys of Solomon and stuff. All magic books, including the wonderful, wonderful books and commentaries and rituals of Aleister Crowley, serve only as examples of another magician's work.
Wow.
And, it's so easy to think that, okay, if I do this ritual just like Aleister Crowley, or just like Abramelin the Mage, or just like Abraham the Jew, then just like a recipe book, if I do it just like this, I'll get this, I'll get a cake.
Yes.
Okay. No. The best thing you can get out of that material, I'm not saying don't memorize the rituals and walk through them and do them, but they're only just to show you how one magician historically utilized these elements, these forces, these words, these sounds, these tools, in order to get in touch with their inner words, their inner tools, their inner vibrations. And the only reason that you would even practice these things is to get in sync with what one person did, in the same way that it really would be helpful if you were going to learn to say, learn to play the piano. It's very helpful for you to learn the skills necessary for you to learn that Beethoven piece,
right.
Sonata, okay? But it's Beethoven's art, okay?
Right.
It's Beethoven's magic. But you learn that Beethoven's magic, and in a sense, allow yourself to be possessed by that for the sake of performance. But what it's really done was readjusted a billion things inside you, gives you a billion skills, has exercised and built up the muscles and the nerves and the the framework of how music flows.
Wow.
So you can do your magic your way on your sheet of paper with your group of musicians that you put together. Okay, so the in order for you to be anything but a temporary vessel for Beethoven, you've got to be your own Beethoven using all the skills and all the understanding that you learned when you mastered the Beethoven.
Got it. I got it. Got it. That makes such sense to me. You know, because it's like whenever I've been, you know, I'm not a magician or musician either, really. But the, you know, I love practicing scales. And I did start noticing the more I practice the scales, the more other aspects of music just seem to come more naturally. And
not only that, but I bet your dreams have even changed.
That's what I was about. I was literally about to say I would dream about playing. In the dreams, I would be practicing music. The dreams would be carrying on whatever this thing was. And that's when I started thinking, whoa, music is actually way more than I initially thought it was. This stuff is that I did start thinking, oh, this is magic. Like it's some kind of magical system that is disguised as music. There's no way this isn't magic. You look at sheet music, for example, the grand staff and all that stuff. It's clearly this is magic that people call music. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, because not only are you a great practicing magician, you're also a great musician.
Well, I don't know about that, but I'm a musician.
Okay, a musician, fine. You know, but still, you know, a lot of great songs on your YouTube and on your Wikipedia, when I was reading about you, what was the name of your original band or one of your albums? Something.
Oh, Charlie D and Milo.
See, this is what I was. It's so cool. My name is Charles Duncan. So I thought, what a cool synchronicity.
Whoa.
Yeah, my dad used to call me Charlie D.
Whoa.
I know.
Well, that is very interesting. And back in the day, Charlie and I got together when I first moved back to California. And I guess I was still 17, I guess, when we met. And of course, we were taking psychedelics and were totally into writing songs and music from a spiritual awakening point of view, a psychedelic spiritual awakening point of view. So we fancied ourselves that our music was not only you know, popular in style, but the message was always one of mystical awakening kind of things. We really loved we were inspired by the Beatles and sure. And you know, Donovan and Cat Stevens and so we purposefully tried to make our music an expression of our pitiful teenage, late teenage grasp of spiritual awakening. And of course, we were just totally lightweights, you know. But the idea, a lot of our songs, as a matter of fact, our first songbook of songs that we eventually, you know, got publishers interested in, we got ideas for every one of the songs by just smoking a bunch of hash and opening up a cult dictionary at random and writing a song about the first thing our fingers felt.
Cool.
Yeah.
That's cool.
But the idea that the technique of fine music in a mathematical sense really was the furthest thing from our mind. We just wanted to know, well, do you think we can get this recorded? And we were lucky enough to play live in enough places to, you know, get a general audience response. But the audience too was going through that pivotal time in the awakening, that psychedelic mid and late 60s was truly a crack in time, an aberration. It was a quantum leap in human consciousness, and it was happening everywhere. Even people that weren't aware of it were just thinking differently.
Right.
And I gave music a rest after our second, after our album and second single. I gave it a rest for 25 years because not because we weren't successful at it. It's because we were. And the lifestyle of, you know, Hollywood era recording artists and working band in the late 60s, early 70s was really a wild, it was not good for my health.
I get it. I know what you mean. It's brutal. I, as a touring comedian, you know, it's over time, it's crazy what it can do to you. Just to be constantly traveling around and performing, and always you've become a night owl, and I get it. Why you would stop.
And so but what didn't stop was my interest in spiritual things. So, and because I had been a working musician since I was 14, truly a working musician at 14. And I helped support my family till I moved away at 17. I had done nothing else with my life in the real world.
Yeah.
And so I was totally unprepared for objective reality. And, you know, I had no job skills or anything else. Music had gotten me by until that point. But I was still reading that occult dictionary. I was still reading that Tao Te Ching. I was still doing that yoga. I was still interested in that stuff. And for 25 years, I just kept getting more and more interested in spiritual and occult things. And when I finally realized I was never going to be a first-rate Eastern mystic,
yeah,
because I'm just too damn lazy. It's hard to be an Eastern mystic.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, and so I said, well, I'm too lazy for this. I got to see if there's a Western equivalent to this that sort of panders to my my Western exoteric mind, and that's when I ran into the Kabbalah. And Kabbalah to tarot, and tarot and Kabbalah to Crowley, and I just happened to be just insanely lucky to meet Phyllis Seckler and Grady McMurtry, two students of Crowley, older students of Crowley. They introduced me to Israel Regardie. And so all these living superstars of the Western magical tradition, I just sort of fell in with their company and their influence. And if it wasn't for them, I probably would have been, remained freaked out about Crowley for another 10 years.
Sure.
But it was really comforting to have somebody actually say, "Oh dear God, boy, no, he didn't eat babies," you know, or, you know, it explained to me all the things that most people superstitiously freak out when they hear stories about Crowley. In 15 words, they just totally explained that away, and it made me feel stupid for being such a chicken shit.
Oh gosh, that's so, but you're not a chicken shit. I mean, look at his poetry. Look at White Stains. Look at some of those poems. They're beyond blasphemous. You know, I love Crowley. I don't even know why I love Crowley. I always will love Crowley. I don't know why. I don't get it. I don't understand it very much, but anytime I sit down and read any of his essays, I feel so good, and it makes me feel so happy, and there's something really funny about him that isn't, that, like, I recognize in him some kind of comedian or something, and I really like it a lot. And you know, even my wife, I was reading one of these poems from White Stains. I'm like, listen to this. All this time I've been yapping about how great he is, and here's something about pederasty or something, you know? And I'm like, listen to this. How embarrassing. Look, why would he write this poem? And even she was like, don't be a chicken shit. She didn't say that, but she was like, he doesn't literally mean it, Duncan. And yeah. I felt so dumb too. Jazz, my wife, she's not into this. She doesn't do this, but she just naturally's like, you're going to take it literally?
Yeah.
But don't you think it is justified that people feel, at the very least, mixed emotions about him? Because he was intentionally putting that stuff out there on sacrifice, you know? And do you feel like there is a little bit of responsibility for a person? You know, Crowley puts out there, the thing he said when he was, I think, alluding to masturbation. But, you know, someone who hears that and is confused, they might think it's okay to, I'll kill babies for power because Crowley did. You know what I mean? Isn't there some ethical responsibility to not send out these signals that could be so easily misinterpreted?
Perhaps you're absolutely right. And in remember, Crowley's a genius, and geniuses don't always understand where non-geniuses are coming from.
Right.
And generally speaking, he thought it was an easy way to freak out the freak-outable.
Hmm.
Because the freak-outable aren't really ready for the art of magic.
So it's a force field.
Yeah. And it served that purpose. And I don't even think he thought too much about it. I think he thought, if you were too stupid not to see through this, you're really too stupid and superstitious at the moment to actually grasp the big picture of what magic is, and I'd just sooner not screw with you.
I love that you say, right, you keep saying right now. I think that's such a compassionate way to put it. And I appreciate that you keep saying that, because I think you're recognizing some people just go through phases. And sometimes the phase you're in, maybe it's more like you need to learn about, like, how to save money in your bank account. You know, like, you need to learn basic earth stuff.
When I found out more about Crowley, I bought that Thoth tarot deck when I was still sort of an naive, young, superstitious BOTA tarot person. And I got that Thoth tarot deck, and I'd only just read Crowley's name here and there, and I didn't think much about it. And that tarot deck sort of scared me because it was so incredibly beautiful that I thought maybe the devil had to make it. And then I find out in an occult dictionary that Crowley was some kind of a Satanist. And I freaked out. I gave the cards away. And it really took a friend of mine, an older friend of mine, who had read Crowley's biography, to say, "Why did you give those cards away?" I said, "Well, it says he was a Satanist." And he said, "Well, wasn't he a Satanist?" And he said, no, he wasn't a Satanist." "Well, yes, he was. But no. If he's a Satanist, he's a good kind of Satanist. And you'll really love this guy because everything you think you want to learn about this subject, about the tarot and the Kabbalah and the magic and all of this stuff, you're going to have to come face to face with everything this guy wrote because he knew more about it than any other person in the 20th century."
Wow.
And again, I was lucky to have a good friend who was frank enough and was honest enough with me to say, "You're being a freaking idiot.
Right.
Wake up, kid." And not everyone has that. And I think Crowley, during his lifetime, never fully grasped that everybody didn't have a friend like that.
No.
To slap him in the face and say, "Listen, okay, if you can't get over this, you know, you're never going to be able to get over that demon you just conjured in your bedroom."
Wow, right. But, you know, again, I'm just speaking from an outsider's perspective here. As a superstitious person sometimes who does love Crowley, but one thing that's very frustrating to me these days especially is because of some of the stuff that is, you know, intentional distortions or force fields that's out there, you have entire swarms of superstitious people like at the level of, like, you know, pitchforks and torches who see anything that doesn't fit in with their, you know, Judeo-Christian symbol set. And they say, "Oh, no. If you're into magic, number one, you are a Satanist." They don't even understand there might be some difference between those two things. And number two, if you're involved in any of this stuff, then you like to hurt kids. And you know what I mean? Like, that to me seems like a kind of dangerous reality that's becoming more and more apparent as people continue to be confused. And I find it to be quite disturbing, only because anyone I've ever met, Satanists, practicing magicians, they would never hurt a kid.
No.
And so to me, there's a bigger problem, which is we don't want to go back to the witch burnings. You know, we don't want to go back. And sometimes these days, it feels like we're just a blackout away from the wood being stacked up again, you know?
Well, I think there's never been a time when we weren't just a blackout away. And the best we can do is try to get along with our neighbors, no matter what they may think. You know, for about 9 years, I accidentally fell into a pretty good job. Constance just loved it that we had such a steady paycheck and everything.
Yeah.
I didn't mind it because it gave me time. I could do what I was paid to do, and the rest of the time I could write books. I wrote 5 books in 9 years, right? Wow. At work.
That's awesome.
But the thing was, most, no, I'd say everybody around me would definitely not understand anything of where I was coming from or what I was doing. But we did have so much else in common. We could talk about guacamole. We could talk about our favorite movies and stuff, and if they were Christians or Jews, I could talk about you know, well, I was raised a Methodist myself, and
right,
you know, and we all had tastes in music. We had shared tastes in just 99% of our lives we had in common. And for the first 5 years, that's all we talked about. And because I could talk about the same things that interest them without feeling the need to rub my spirituality in their nose.
Yes.
And it got so that I could say anything and they would say, well, that doesn't freak me out because Lon said it. And if Lon said it, it must be normal, because Lon thinks just like me, you know.
Right. And do you the question I'm about to ask, we're almost at 2 o'clock. Do you have a little bit more time?
Yes, but not too much more.
Okay, then this is my final question for you, and thank you so much for the time you've given me. What you just said to me seems to validate something I've been very hopeful about, which is that this impulse, the intelligent people have to not disturb others, it implies an organized group of people out there who've collectively come to this conclusion. And I know that you, you know, maybe you could talk just a little bit about the OTO, Freemasons, and the reason we might need to have lodges or places where people could have different sorts of conversations that aren't about guacamole and help dispel some of the superstition out there regarding these particular ways that human beings organize and get together.
Well, who knows if there'll ever be a time in the next few years even when we're going to be able to get together in the same way that we did just last year.
Right.
But say the Freemasons, because the Freemasons are just a beautiful, beautiful example of a group that is very successful. It's the largest fraternal organization in the world. It has mystic ceremonies, and the mystic ceremonies in and of themselves, from a magician's point of view, are insanely, wonderfully magical and can be a wonderful self-transformational experience. But it doesn't rub the member's nose in the fact that that might be what the experience is. As a matter of fact, they go out of their way not to interpret that experience to the membership.
Huh.
And they oblige the members to be tolerant of one another. And because we're all bound by the same arbitrary, you know, oaths of fellowship and things. And that we take our oaths on our own particular holy books, you know. If you want to be an esoteric Mason, you can go all as deep as you want in your own private studies and practices and sort of collateral Masonic under the radar gatherings and such.
Huh.
And if you don't, you don't. It's a huge, huge tent. It's a huge non-religious spiritual tent. And it doesn't matter that most of the old farts would just completely freak out if they knew what you really thought, but it doesn't matter because you don't care what they think either.
Wow. Interesting. Wow. This hour went by in a second. I feel really fortunate that I got to connect with you in this way. I know lots of people listening are going to want to hear more from you. Can you tell people how they can find you?
At the moment, my Facebook page, just my Facebook friend page, is the about as close as I get to a, you know, a daily blog kind of thing. But if all my books and my music are on Amazon, if just Google my name, Lon Milo Duquette. And I have a, for my music, I've got a Reverb Nation page, but I'm on Spotify and CD Baby and Amazon too. So if you, I'm just everywhere. If you just type my name in, you'll find interesting things, hopefully.
Yes, you will. Trust, you are a rabbit hole, sir. I spend a lot of time going around. You're an amazing person, and thank you. Thank you so much for this. All the links you need to find Mr. Duquette will be at DougGutrussell.com. Lon, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Duncan.
A tremendous thank you to Lon Milo Duquette for appearing on this episode of the DTFH. All the links you need to find him will be at DougGutrussell.com. And a big thank you to Squarespace, to Feels, to DHM Detox for sponsoring this podcast. And most importantly, thank you for listening. I will see you next week. Until then, Hare Krishna.